Vous voyez, vous allez rentrer, toi, hier. Ah, mais dis qu'est-ce que tu brins, quand même, bon. Without them to be hard to work, I mean, to lecture. And as those who don't have, I mean, the Gemaras, I suggested that they bring the Sefer HaGodeh, I mean, here's the collection. Of course, those, I mean, who are in Aramaic, they translate into Hebrew, but basically it's a literal, it's almost literal, the translation. So it doesn't matter much. All right, let's start. I mean, I would like in general to speak about Rabbi Akiva's life. But before we begin to delve in the various stages of his life, I would like simply to say the reason why I've chosen this topic for tonight. And the reason is simple, that Lag BaOmer is linked with Rabbi Akiva. In a very mysterious fashion, I don't know exactly. All we have is just one source consisting of three lines. The Gemara in Yevamot, Daf Samadbeis, Amud Beis. Amru Rabbi Akiva Eimer, Lo Matero de Yaldishes, one studied Torah in his youth. Your material is a knife, he should also study and teach, rather. Teach there in his own. Hoyle Talmidim, the elder say, if he has trained many pupils while he is young, Yile Talmidim, the knife, he should continue training pupils, disciples, even at his old age. Nema Babeka Zraza, Rechol, Lehre, Valtanak. Omru means, the tradition is, we don't know who the Omru is, it's anonymous, Omru, they accept. Name of the Elev Zugim Talmidim, 12,000 pairs of disciples, it means 24,000 disciples. Oyele la Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 disciples. Migavat ad Antipatris. Migavat is a city up the north, Eretz Israel, it's not far from the Golan Heights. It was the Chelkis Aldon, the part of Eretz Israel which belongs to David Don. And Don was the most northern boundary in Eretz Israel. Usually, when the Pesach wants to say that everybody in Eretz Israel assembled in Don Rabbeer Siba. Gavat is Don. In Tanakh, it's called Givaton. Chazal call it Gamat. Antipatris is a city which Herod was founded in memory of his father. And it is northwest of Jerusalem. It's not far from Masada. It's on the border of the Judean desert. It means, and the Gemara says that he had 24,000 disciples from Gamat to Antipatris. You understand me that we have disciples all over the land. It's almost the whole territory. Yeah. It means we have thousands, Chazal means thousands of disciples all over the land. Of course, he was the teacher par excellence, relative. And he taught the great deal. He used to assemble. He used to teach assembly. He used to assemble people and teach there in the square market. The street corner. He was, as a matter of fact, an itinerant teacher. He used to travel from place to place and teach, disseminate knowledge of Torah. So here it means 24,000 disciples all over Eretz Yisroel, the land. The Kulon Meitzu, and all of them died the Perek Yachot, within one season. And the Gemara gives a very strange reason for that death. Literally, Noagu Kovei Zelaze. They didn't treat each other respectfully with respect. Because the quarrels, they used to humiliate each other. In a way, they did not act with deference and respect toward each other. Boyo Elam Shomein and the world, I mean the world of Torah, There was a great desolation in the world. After, I mean, Rashi says the Torah was forgotten, completely forgotten. It means all scholars died somehow, mysteriously. Before Rabbi Akiva, until Rabbi Akiva came, Eitzel Rabbi Seinus for the Dorim. He came to few scholars in Dorim. Probably the southern part of Eretz Yisrael. They turned over him, and he taught them. He found a few disciples in Dorim, and he taught them all over. The Torah, he taught for many, many years, to thousands of disciples. Who are they? Rabbi Meir, one, Rabbi Yehuda, two, I mean, Rabbi Yehuda, three, Rabbi Shimon, four, Rabbi Lozab, and Samuel, five. They're not a great scholar, but he trained them. And instead of 24,000 Talmudim, he apparently reconciled himself with new task to teach just five people. Instead of 24, he had just five disciples. Then they need to take all the Torah, and those five people have saved the Torah from being forgotten. Tane, there's another braise, Kula Meitu in the Pesach Parasha. They all died between Pesach and Shavuot. As a matter of fact, the Gaonim say that this is the reason for our mourning, for our practice of mourning. Between Pesach and Atzeres during the Sfira time, because Rabbi Akiva lost all his disciples, thousands of disciples that season. Of course, we don't know exactly what happened and what was the cause of their death. The Gemara says because they did not treat each other with respect, deference. And of course, some historians want to say that the Gemara simply the Braise, it's an old Braise. What the Braise wanted to convey is that his disciples joined the ranks of Bar Kokhba. Of course, Rabbi Akiva was actively involved in the rebellion and insurrection of Bar Kokhba, actively involved. Actually, well, and apparently was executed later because of that. So you don't know exactly. But actually, you don't know the date of the execution. I mean, the year when. Some say it was between 132 and 135 coming year. Some say it was much later. Very hard to guess. I mean. But Rabbi Akiva was very much involved. First of all, we consider Bar Kokhba as the King's Messiah. Melech HaMashiach, Dor Kech of Miyaki. The Rambam writes, even though we don't know the source, where it derived it from, but the Rambam says that he was simply the valet of Bar Kokhba, Mesi Caleb, the valet of Bar Kokhba. He used to carry the ammunition of Bar Kokhba's sword. Yes. Probably there is a sword which the Rambam derives. We don't know. We don't know the sword. But he was an active participant in the Bar Kokhba insurrection. As a matter of fact, we find that Rabbi Akiva traveled a great deal. He told us he was in Africa, North Africa, probably, Northern Africa, and many other places. He was in Arabia. What did he travel for? There is no doubt to recruit volunteers and to simply to solicit funds for the insurrection. After all, it lasted at least 3 years. We know it 3 years. And the insurrection was at the beginning very successful, very successful, very victorious. But finally, they succumbed to the military power after all. So some historians say that the 24,000 Talmidim, I mean the thousands of Rabbi Akiva's disciples, his adherents, his admirers, followed their master, and they rallied around Bar Kokhba. And of course, when Bar Kokhba lost the war, he was defeated at Beta and Tisha B'Av. Of course, I mean, apparently everything was lost, but apparently they were killed. Many of them were killed between Pesach and Atzeres. Many battles were fought. We don't know, you see. The Chum Bayesheni had a historian which gave us almost a detailed description of the war and of the events that transpired and whom they committed. It was just different. So you have a detailed description of many details. But however, we have no historian which has somehow perpetuated the story of the insurrection, of the Bar Kokhba insurrection, 65 years later. So we know just very little about it. We know just, we can derive something from fragments in the Gemara. The Gemara was not interested in telling us the story in detail, precisely. So you know very little. So that's what historians suggest, that the Gemara speaks about people who lost their lives while fighting for their homeland. Right. But what is interesting here, and what something else is very interesting, if actually the Braise, we have to decode these Braise, so to say, because the Braise could not, apparently, it was forbidden, the Jews were forbidden, to write about the war, about the insurrection. So the insurrection was the Romans were very cruel. They were not as cruel during the Chum by Sheni. At that time they were a bit liberal, but when they suppressed the resurrection, Bar Kokhba, they displayed so much cruelty and ruthlessness. And all the religious persecutions were ushered, commenced with the suppression of the Bar Kokhba rebellion. All the Asura Rugemauchus are actually the aftermath of this rebellion. So apparently, the recording of the rebellion, by Jewish historians was forbidden. So whatever they have is in code language, you know. So if it is so, then it's very strange, you don't know about it. You see, when the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and Rome, the preceding years, has invaded Eretz Israel, we know from Josephus, that Rome started first to invade Galilee. Matter of fact, Rome came from Syria and Lebanon, the army. And they invaded systematically the northern part of Eretz Israel, the Galilee. Matter of fact, Josephus himself was the commander-in-chief of the army, who was to defend the Gauls against the Roman invasion. You know the story, that he lost the battle, they were defeated, and then he surrendered. He was taken prisoner by the Romans, and they appointed him, finally appointed his secretary to the commander-in-chief, to Titus. So, but it was a systematic invasion from the Galilee until they reached the boundaries of Judea. In Judea, they had trouble, the Romans, particularly Jerusalem. Matter of fact, Jerusalem was about a couple of years, 2 years under siege, until they cracked the fortress, the wall, and they penetrated into Jerusalem. The Bar Kokhba insurrection, the way historians describe, did not start in the Galilee at all. The Galilee was not involved in the insurrection at all. The insurrection started in Judea, in the Judean hills. Bar Kokhba and men apparently gigantic strength and great fascination. Like a superman record. But started it, and he dislodged many garrisons, the Roman garrisons in the various cities in Judea, surrounding Jerusalem, in the tank of Jerusalem. And then Severus, who was removed by Adrian, from Britannia, and commanded and got instructions to lead the Roman army in Judea, because it was very serious. And Severus was the greatest general, and he was in Britannia. And they removed him, they brought him from Britannia to Eretz Israel to lead the army against Bar Kokhba. You can understand, the magnitude of the rebellion, the most brilliant general in Rome, strategist, who was told, to leave Britannia and to come to the Middle East. It was not so simple at all. So So apparently, I mean, the popular opinion is that he came through the Mediterranean straight to Galilee, coming to Judea, because Galilee was not involved at all. And the devastation took place in Judea at that time. At the time the Jews left, I mean, Yehuda of Judea, and they began to flee. Many fled across the sea. Many fled to neighboring countries, like Iraq, Syria, and many settled in Galilee, because the Galilee was not devastated. And the battles took place in Judea. The Galilee was quiet. But if this Bryce actually refers to the confrontation between the Kochba and the Romans, so, and they died, they were killed from Gabbat. The Gabbat is up north, I mean, not far from the Golan Heights. So apparently the resurrection was not limited to the province of Judea, but actually embraced, I mean, the whole land, from the south to the north. I mean, it's something new. Now, let us leave, I mean, the historical problem. It will never be resolved. I mean, it's very hard to say what the Bryce wanted to convey to us. Might have some historical significance, and we have to decode the Bryce and to guess that exactly what the Bryce meant. What's interesting is that the Bryce, but Moses Gainim, all of them, have stated that is the reason, I mean, those events which transpired so many hundreds of years ago, I mean, actually are still, I mean, responsible for the practice of mourning and availing during this season. I mean, what happened to Lag Bemer? Why is Lag Bemer an exception? We don't know. There is in certain texts, in certain Kisveyah, if the reading is not from Pesach ad Atzeres, not from Pesach until Shavuot, but from Pesach ad Preis Atzeres, from Pesach until Preis Atzeres. Preis Atzeres means 15 days before Shavuot. Preis means to split, to cut in half, to slice. A month is 30. The Preis, whenever you say in Hebrew, Preis Achag, means 15 days prior to the holiday. So it means they died between Pesach and 15 days prior to Shavuot. It means 49 minus 15 is 34. That's why the meaning of this farm is that they observe Lag Bomer is not a holiday, but Lag Bomer is one of the days of mourning. The next day means Monday morning. The Lamed Dalet is the last day of mourning. And since Mitzvah Hayom Kikulei, you know, but how do you observe, I mean, Achmolis Lanaveli? The last day of Shiva, one does not sit through the entire day, the whole day, but they get up in the morning. A part of the day is considered as a full day. So that's why Lamed Dalet Boemer, the 34th day in Emer, Avelis Shiveh is suspended. That's still the Minhag Sfar. They observe 34 days of Emer, from Pesach until the 34th of the Emer. Yeah, but our minhag is different. I mean, the minhag Ramor, minhag Ashkenazim, is that you observe the entire period, season, of Sfira, beginning with Pesach, and ending with Erev Shavuos, with the exception of one day, Lag Bomer. Why Lag Bomer? We don't know. Why Lag Bomer was chosen? We don't know. We have many, many interpretations. As a matter of fact, I mean, Dataz says it in the 16th century, and he is right, Dataz, that actually as far as the mourning that we observe in commemoration of the death of Rabbi Akiva's disciples, some catastrophe took place, some disaster struck, and that disaster actually has wiped off center of Teres throughout Eretz Yisrael. Whether it is due to the war, the Bakorba war, or some other, or another, the other factors, it's hard to guess. But you know that Bryce had told us, I mean, of a very tragic event, a disaster which struck, I mean, the intellectual world in Eretz Yisrael, and in a short time, I mean, many, many centers were wiped out. What happened? How it happened? we know very little about. So actually, that apparently, for the, I mean, as far as this event is concerned, we observe until, actually, we should observe until Lamed Dalet Beimer or Lamed Gimel Beimer. The rest of the sphere, which we begin to observe on Monday, is in commemoration of another event, namely the Crusade. The Crusade in the Middle Ages. The Crusade actually took place in the most atrocious and the most ferocious massacres of the Jews, particularly during the First Crusade in 1096, took place exactly about the same time as the events in antiquity pertaining to Rabbi Akiva Talmidim. And that's why the Chachmei Ashkenaz have prolonged the days of mourning from 33 or 34 days to 49. Actually, we observe mourning during Sfirah for two reasons. For one, in commemoration of one event, which lies in antiquity, which actually is not too clear to us. We don't know what happened. All we have recorded is the three lines here. That 24,000 Talmidim have died as an epidemic or whatever it was, I mean, a plague, died within a short season. And second, because of the Crusade. The Crusade has devastated, actually, the Ashkenazi center of Torah. Worms, Magenta, Worms, Mine, Spear, and it actually was wiped off. Old Balatheses, old scholars, the greatest scholars of all. The school of the Balatheses actually came to an end. And that's the reason why you observe mourning, I mean days of mourning, from Lag Beimer until Shavuot. Now let's talk about, I just want to give you an explanation. So people should not look for kules, I mean, for a way out of that, I mean, because Jewish history was perpetuated. And it's in commemoration of tragic events. You know very well that the Bar Kokhba insurrection and the way it ended is reminiscent of the Hitler Holocaust. So the cruelty and the ruthlessness. And of course, it's not numerically, you can't compare. Numerically, the Hitler Holocaust, I mean, transcends anything in Jewish history. But as far as cruelty is concerned, the complete devastation and destruction of Jewish towns and villages, centers of Torah, because Judea, I mean, after Bethel, was just arid land, it was a desolate country. There were no Jews, and in Yerushalayim, it was completely. Was plowed over, and the Jews were enjoined from entering Jerusalem. They changed the name of Jerusalem at that time, and they planted on the Harabais and the Temple Mount. They erected a classical Roman idol, and so forth. I mean, and then the center of Torah moved to Galil, Ushesh, Parem, Tveria, Tiberias. And actually, what happened? It's almost parallel to the events which happened after the destruction of the First Temple. After the destruction of the First Temple, the Jews lost independence, political independence. The aristocracy was exiled. The royal house was deported. I mean, of course, Nebuchadnezzar, I mean, and his legions, I mean, of course, destroyed Jerusalem. But the people as such remained in Eretz Israel. There was no exile. There was no God. Very nice. They lost, I mean, Nebuchadnezzar had the Babylonians had, the governors in Eretz Israel, but the people remained steadfast in their loyalty to the land, and they were not dislocated at all. You know, then the dislocation of the Jews after the Churban Bayis Rishon took place, dislocation, with the murder of Gedaliah ben Achikam. People are not who are not enlightened to ask, why should he fast for Gedaliah ben Achikam? The person was killed, so why should he fast for it? The answer is that it was not just the death of an individual. It is the killing of Gedaliah ben Achikam. The real exile, the gullet, the gas, and the displacement of the Jews, dislocation of the Jews from Eretz Israel, Today, with the Golis Rishon, as we call, commenced with the killing of Dari ben Achikam. And exactly what happened during the Bayis Rishon, immediately after the Churban Bayis Rishon, transpired also after the Churban Bayis Sheni. With the Churban Bayis Sheni, the Jews were not exiled from their land. Of course, they deported many aristocracy, intellectuals, but the message remained. I mean, the towns and villages, we are too loyal, to leave the land. And the Romans were not interested at all in displacing the Jews. Not at all. But what the Churban Bayis Sheni did not accomplish, the insurrection of Bar Kokhba, they accomplished the Kirishit. Then Judea was completely devastated and the Jews were removed from the land. Many fled, as I told you, to adjacent countries across the sea. Many moved up to Galilee. That's exactly what happened. So when we speak about Goles and the exile, the Goles Rishon, the Goles Sheni, the first exile, the second, were not results of the Churban Bayis Rishon Bayis Sheni, but results of events which followed the Churban later on. Bar Kokhba followed the Churban about 65 years. Churban was 70, and this was about 135. Beta fell 135. So it means Bar Kokhba approximately was in power about 3 years. So it means 132. It's about 62 years later. As a matter of fact, we have proof from the Mishneh that there was, even after Churban, there was a Bezna Godel in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was still, they devastated Yerushalayim, they destroyed Yerushalayim, but they rebuilt Yerushalayim, the Jews. Because the Gemara speaks about Bezna Godel in Yavne, Bezna Godel in Yerushalayim, which existed simultaneously. Very strange. Very strange. And quite possible that pilgrims used to come to Yerushalayim, even after the Churban. Even after the Churban. There is also a possibility that the Korban Pesach used to offer the Korban Pesach. Even after the Churban Bayis Sheni. So it means that life was normal in Eretz Yisrael, in Yehuda, after the Churban Bayis Sheni. Bar Kokhba insurrection was finished. We speak about Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was a very strange person. His father apparently, that's what the Rambam says, the source of the Chazal. Father was a ger, was a convert. That means he's not of Jewish extraction. His father was a goy who converted. Was very poor, Rabbi Akiva was very poor. It's quite interesting. Rabbi Akiva had a classmate, an associate. His name was Elisha ben Avuya, who was a descendant of the aristocracy, the Jewish aristocracy in Jerusalem. Avuyo, the Yerushalmi says, Avuyo, the father, Migdele Yerushalayim, was one of the most prominent citizens of Yerushalayim. And Richard ben Avuyo started to study as a young child. His father could afford to send him to the academy. He studied under Rabbi Eliezer and under Rabbi Yeshua, he studied. When Rabbi Akiva came, he was about 40 years old, according to the tradition. One tradition says that Rabbi Akiva came together with his little son to study in an elementary school, ABC. He used to hold the tablet on one side, and his little son held it on the other side. And the same teacher taught both of them. Always that, he moved out. And the rest of them, other Rabbi Nelson told them. When Rabbi Akiva came, Elisha ben Avuya was a prominent scholar by that time. He was one of the most capable, the most brilliant scholars in the Academy of Rabbi Yisrael and Rabbi Eliezer. And certainly Elisha ben Avuya was Da je situacija kontemplacija, da ne znači što da kide. To je mi poor boy, šeta, neoliterate, some people say that Abbas Elisha ben Avui is saying, which was recorded in Kirti Ovi, very strange. The Gemara didn't like, Chazal didn't like somebody, he simply never talked about it, he just ignored it. The Gemara, we have a few stories about Elisha ben Avui, his biography, what happened to him. The Gemara is Gigi in Yerushalmi has more material than the Bavli about Elisha ben Avui. But he has never been quoted by anyone. He's never been quoted, with the exception of Kirchhoff. In Kirchhoff there is a quotation by Acher, by Elisha ben Avui. Elisha ben Avui, in her Alenik Shuzokun, the Mordene, the cases of the Yor Mochuk, the Alenik Shuyelet, the Mordene, the cases of the Yor Chodosh. It's permanent. So he said, Elisha ben Avui said it to the daughter of the I see the king as a contradiction of 40 years old. So how much can he accomplish? He's an old man. How much can he learn? His mind is not receptive anymore. The memory is not as good as the death of a young child. And apparently he was very arrogant in his relations with Rabbi Akiva. What happened, you know what happened? Rabbi Akiva became the greatest scholar. One of the greatest heroes in Jewish history. And Elisha ben Avui became a traitor. His name was completely erased from the annals of Jewish history. And that was quite possible as the edict by Hadrian against religious observance, which was the cause of Rabbi Akiva's martyr's death, this edict was suggested to the Roman government by Elisha ben Avui. Two classmates. And they had Rabbi Meir studied Torah under Elisha ben Avui, and then he came to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Meir studied Torah under Paul. Now, Chazal say that the 24,000 Talmidim died because they have not respected, they didn't respect each other, didn't treat each other with respect and deference. And here already Rabbi Akiva's opinion, an opinion by Rabbi Akiva, a saying by Rabbi Akiva, comes to expression. The fact that you have to treat your fellow man with respect and deference, and particularly not insult anybody, or not to display disrespect or contempt. You know what? Amali v'chaveri ever causes humiliation or insult somebody in public. Chazal say it's like murder, you know, to the safe or dummy. When someone embarrass somebody in public, it's to the safe or dummy. You know, this is Yuta Mai, the memorial, Mutab. Rather than embarrass his friend or someone, any human being in public, embarrassment in public. Something which modern men doesn't know. Particularly politicians don't know. Embarrass a person in public, this is exactly the ABC of politics. If you embarrass your adversary in public, so you have a better chance to win the election. Yes, but this is due to Rabbi Akiva, the author and one who the originator of that idea. Rabbi Akiva, we have in Pirkei Avos, we have a few sayings by Rabbi Akiva in Pirkei Avos. Hu haya omer, Rabbi Akiva says, Chaviv ha'adam shenivra betzelem, beloved is man who was created in the image. Chibo yeseiro nedar aslay. An extraordinary love is made known to him, Shinivra Betzalem, that he was created Betzalem Rekim. Shinemar ki Betzalem Rekim was his order. As a matter of fact, what period did we read this afternoon? For it is the third period, three. This is the, you have a period of it. So Rabbi Akiva emphasized the significance of human dignity. The idea of human dignity, plays a tremendous role in halacha, human dignity. I mean, human dignity, which is not limited to a Jew, I mean, which is universal, I mean, encompasses and embraces every human being, learned and illiterate, whether it's a simpleton or a scholar, philosopher, doesn't matter, of all professions and all stations in life. I mean, this is what Rabbi Akiva, this is his first, Rabbi Akiva saying, what does it mean? Chibo yisero nedas le shenivro betzalem. Shnema ki betzalem rakim moshe sodom. I believe I'm quoting this manna correctly. What does it mean? Why this duplication and why the redundancy? He said chol v'olam shenivro betzalem, and then he repeated chibo yisero nedas le shenivro betzalem. What does it mean? What does it mean? So the Rambam interprets in Pirush HaMishnah, chol v'olam shenivro betzalem, I mean, beloved is the man. Well, the man was singled out when he was created in the image of God, the spiritual personality. I mean, nothing else in creation has a spiritual aspect of being, with the exception of man. Man is not just a physiological body, but he's a spiritual personality as well. Yes. Whatever God could have created man like that and not tell him about it. But God did two things. He created man as a spiritual personality and he informed him. He told him that, you are a spiritual personality, and please protect, I mean, your dignity, I mean, and don't lose it. I mean, God could have created and not informed man at all. He could have created without informing man. But beloved is man, chovi v'odom shenivra betzalem. He doesn't say shenema ki betzalem ki masalem, he doesn't say that he was created in the image of God. In addition to creating man in his image, he informed and advised man that he has a great, great potential. If man remains ignorant of the great potential which was implanted in him, I mean, he would have never realized it, he would have never actualized the potential. But God told him, it was rich nema, he would tell him that he must have thought of it. As a matter of fact, God not only told man that he was created in his image, but there are many halachos, which are nurtured by Rabbi Akiva's idea, Chovi v'odom shenivro betzalem. What halachos are you? Yes, with Abriyas, of course, burial, death and burial, and Jews, I mean, the halachos during his burial, of course, are rooted in the concept of Vidabriya. But more than that, it is correct. Burial is rooted in Vidabriya. The Ramban says in Chumash that the laws of burial are applicable to Jew and non-Jew alike. The killer of the king told him. The soul of lost away is simply because he's the image of God. Once in the image of God, he's not only Jewish, he was created in the image of God, every man. That's what Rabbi Akiva says, Chol v'odom shenivro betzalem. Nema ki betzalem rakim osa sodom. Yes. But what else? Many more halachas. Many more halachas. What kind of halachas are there? Huh? You like about it? Yes, no, I doubt it. Simply, the whole civil code, all ginemomines, gzeila egneve, shomrim, teim venitim, if you borrow money, you have to pay. If you don't steal, I mean, don't murder. What do you call all mishpatim, most mishpatim? Mishpatim, you know, you have, the commandments of the Torah are divided into chukim mishpatim. The rational laws, or the so-called, in which our ethos comes to expression, laws which represent morality, and then we have the chukim, the laws which represent the ritual, what you call chukim. The mishpatim represent actually the aspect of Shalom Alekim. The Ramban says that the Shalom Mitzvah near dinim, he doesn't read like the Rambam Dayonim. Dinim means that it pertains to the Cheshem Mishpat, so there is no difference between Jew and Gentile. And the Gentiles are obligated, I mean, to conduct their businesses in accordance with the Chesh Mishpat, not to cheat, not to overcharge, and shame-rim if someone accepted a deposit, he's responsible, liable, and so forth. So, I mean, all the laws are taught. I mean, that's what Ramban said. Because Mishpatim, basically, stem from the idea that man is created with Tzarim Lekim. This Tzarim Lekim is not like the brute in the field, which actually relies on force. Whoever is stronger, is the winner. The weaker kind or the weak animal, is defeated and killed. That is Mishpatim. The Ramban said it. That as far as Mishpatim are concerned, that's the story. Shira Mitzin Stalz Neyar, the Ramban speaks not of Dayonim. Ram has a different, has vocalized it differently. But the Ramban speaks of Dinim. Dinim means all the laws, all the civil laws. What do you call Chesh Mishpat? Dinim Amenes are applicable to Jew and Gentile alike. Because the law is based upon the principle of dignity of man. That's why you need a moral order. That's why he has got to live in a civilized society. That's why brute force is not a deciding factor, no matter how successful sometimes brute force is. But the Torah hated brute force. That's why wickedness is condemned. But that's Adam Kidgei Ayom, if it's like the brute in the field, like the beast in the field, because there's no law. And the Chesh Mishpat, actually, what the Chesh Mishpat wants to establish is a just social order, guaranteeing the rights, inalienable rights of man, and particularly ruling out and condemning the use of force. This is basically it. This is Chazal's Tzarim Elokim. There are certain, of course, like the law of incest, the laws against incest. They're also based upon the concept of human dignity. Because incest actually violates the very principles of human dignity. Human dignity means that man is not a brute. There is a spiritual personality, you're correct. And that's what you have in the Shemitah Tzadunayach, he has most of it. And particularly, Yehadis was very, very sensitive to human, how can I say, to the fact that man does not want to be embarrassed. That man, when humiliated, suffers a great deal. Humiliation to man sometimes is worse than physical pain, very well. Many people will accept physical pain rather than public humiliation or public condemnation or embarrassment. That's like Chazal. We have displayed so much sensitivity and understanding for human tenderness. That men sometimes, you can kill a man, I don't mean actually kill in the physical sense, but you can destroy a man with one word, with a sentence, or with a column in the paper. This modern journalism and what is it based on, embarrassing people and that's why Mosrim, for instance, informers, thrillers, were condemned to Yahadis. You have to understand that there used to be actually sometimes things were eliminated. Because they have no understanding for human sensitivity. And interestingly, this is Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was the one who said, "Chol Yisro Odom, Shinu Yisro Betzalem, Chivo Yisro Neda Aslein, Shinu Yisro Betzalem, Shinu Yisro Betzalem, Otsa Yisro Odom." Interestingly, as a matter of fact, Rabbi Akiva shouldn't have said it. You know why? If Rabbi Akiva were not objective, if Rabbi Akiva has judged the world by his experiences, or by the experiences of the Jewish people, his time, by the experiences of his contemporaries, he shouldn't have said man is a great being because he was created in the image of God. Why shouldn't he have said if the world was unjust and unfair? The world is unfair and unjust now too to the Jewish people. But certainly the times of Rabbi Akiva, it was a very unfair and very unjust and a very cruel world. And his history during his time is soaked in blood. All we know about is martyrs and persecution, martyrdom and persecution, and ruthlessness and dislocation, forceful dislocation of people, and tremendous poverty and death. So the king had no business to say that thing. He can judge the world by his experiences. But apparently, it's very hard now, to, even now, to say, for us to say, the Lord is the leader of the challenge. The Lord is the man who was created in the image of God. And sometimes think where this image of God in man, whether this image is still in existence. But anyway, but certainly it was difficult for the children. But for the children, nevertheless, he rose about his subjective experiences. And he said, no matter how bad the world is, and no matter how corrupt men may sometimes become, be, but its potential is great. And sometimes in the future, men will be purged and will shed off his wickedness. It was superhuman for Adakiva to say, "Praise Adam, Shiva, the Talat." To be universalist and to praise man during this period of Holocaust and disaster, one has got to be very, very great man, a spiritual guy. And how according to Adakiva, does the greatness or dignity of man express itself? In what respect is man great? It's interesting, isn't it? Of course, I mean, when we say man is great, dignity of man, we think always, we are always up to think, I mean, about his technological achievements. That's what we need to think. About his scientific accomplishments. Correct, it's all right. He's intellectual. He's sometimes amazing. I mean, he's very brilliant, no doubt about it. He's very inventive, very brilliant. He's an adventurous man. But how did Rabbi Akiva define dignity of man? Chaviv Odom Shenizra B'Tzalem. Yes, correct. But how, I mean, what does his greatness express like? I wouldn't say that intellectual technology is the highest expression of human greatness. Because technology can be utilized, I mean, for corrupt ends, you know, we've lived through the Hitler period. The German war machine, the period of nuclear energy, I mean, which is utilized for destruction, for the time being. The problem is more precise, finer instruments of destruction. How did Rabbi Akiva define Chaviv Odom Shenizra B'Tzalem?
Wasn't that second
Tzalem was symbol also of the transgression of that Tzalem? Correct. Yes, power, I mean. Yeah, no doubt that man is a powerful being. In the psalm which you quote is correct, that man's greatness is expressed in terms of his power. Till Shatat Achasraglav, you put everything beneath his feet. That means he rules, he is above everything. Yes. Tainel Alosim Kulom Chai Sodo is correct. The man's ability to control the environment is indicative of man's greatness. But this cannot be, it's of course, a man's intellect is actually admirable. I mean, his achievements are glorious. No one has ever doubted it. And we have encouraged men to actually engage in scientific research and so forth. But this cannot exhaust the philosophy of human greatness. Human greatness must express itself in something else besides his intellectual power and might. I mean, not the problem for us with modern money, but he has identify the divine image actually with technological achievement. This is perhaps the problem. This is the problem with Russia, and this is the problem with the Western power. When you speak about human mind, right away the mathematical sciences, like physics and so forth, the exact sciences which gave man unlimited control over his mind. Yeah. But Rabbi Akiva says, who are you now? Rabbi Akiva used to say, the first one. After he said, Chov Olam Shenivra B'Tzalem. Hakeu Tzofui. You still remember that, or you've forgotten it? It's not to take a cigar, you'll find it in the cigar. Yeah, I would advise you to take a cigar, because Hakeu Tzofui. והרשוס לסונו, ובטבע אל המידי, והכי מסרב המעזר, right? It's exactly, I mean, the second statement by him. I want you to understand that the Pere quotes many scholars. Who are you in there? Yeah, he said many things. There are innumerous, I mean, things by Rabatir. Why did he pick out, I mean, those things? Characteristic of his philosophy. It was his motto, so to say. His slogan in life. Who are you in there? He said. Didn't say only that. Hilo said. Shama said, who are you? Only that. Anshina Sagdele. Said many things. But the slogan, the motto, which is characteristic of his philosophy, of his doctrine, Hakil Tzofui, what do you mean Hakil Tzofui? Everything is foreseen. They are shoes nesunah, and freedom is granted. And the teva elam nidhi, and the world is greeted with mercy and kindness. The Hakil is the Reza Master. And everything is in accordance with the preponderance of work. More or less, it's the translation. What did Rabbi Akiva define? Of course, no doubt about it. There's a problem that you deal on philosophy with so many theologians and philosophers wrote violently. So Rabbi Akiva has just expressed it in four words. Akiva Tofu is our system, Simi Sunnah. Everything is foreseen, and yet, there is, and yet, man is free. So Hakil Tzofui, I mean, this is exactly, I mean, Rabbi Akiva doesn't speak here about Jews, you see. Whatever Rabbi Akiva says here in that sentence, there's nothing parochial. There is nothing, no indication that it's limited to a Jew, I mean, still, Hoxus is given to everyone, I mean. So Rabbi Akiva describes here, or rather tries to define, what human dignity consists of, and a man of dignity. What he is supposed to do, how he is supposed to act. What are the principles of human dignity? And what is human dignity today? You now let us see, no? Let us see. Akil Tzofui, has been Akil Tzofui? Everything is foreseen, forecast. What does it mean? Man should know, what should man know? He defines them, Selam Alekim. The definition of Selam Alekim. What should man suppose? I would advise you to take a cigar. Without a cigar, I mean, I'm just speaking, I mean, addressing myself. Will you be so kind and bring the cigar? You didn't expect me when I announced Rabbi Akiva, but I'll tell you the story about his love affair with Rochel, that's all. It's also your study to see what the Gemara told us about it. Right, I don't do it. Page 188. Hakil Tzofui, the Roshish Nesuno, Uvitu Vailom Nodein, the Hakil Isereva Maase. Page 189. Third question. The page before it says, Chavivim, Chorin Rodem, Shnivra B'Tzalem Alekim, Chibra Yusera, Nedar Aklai, Shnivra B'Tzalem Alekim, 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 Hakim Tzofui, V'Oshit Nasuno, U'Vetuba El Amidin, V'Akeil Yusereid Amase. Who are you in there? I mean, it may continue. Hakeil Nosum Be'Rodein, Mitzud Afrusha Kol Achayim, I mean, it means a man can achieve anything against his flesh, and a net is cast over all living things. The Chomesh Sucho, the store is open. Bachem v'nimakiz, and credit is extended to everybody. Bachinkas Pasua, the ledger is open. Bachyot Kesheves, and the hand is writing. Choloreisha Yure, whoever wants to borrow money, and borrow Yove the Yure. V'gaboyim marzirim toder, what did you want to express for that here? What idea? It comes in Akil Tzofui. The second Uriah in a day, Chof, is interpretation of Akil Tzofui. What does it mean, Akil Tzofui? Ah? The this is philosophy. Rabbi Akiva says, correct. Akiva says, he's not seen this theological problem, but Rabbi Akiva is not interested in this theological problem. You know, read the Ram later, I mean, was engaged in quite and dealt in this. Rabbi Akiva was interested in something what men should know. If he wants to be a dignified being, and if he wants simply to preserve the image of God and not to desecrate it and not to defile it, there's got to know what it means, Akil Sofis. What does it mean, Akil Sofis? That man is a responsible being. There is moral responsibility to man. Man should know that whatever he does, I mean, he's responsible for the result. I mean, there is reward and punishment. I mean, life is not just anarchy. Life is not just chaos. Life, I mean, man was created for certain tasks. Akil Sofi means God expects man to accomplish. Man is a responsible being, or rather, I would say, a committed being. He's a committed being. Man is not, did not come into this world in order just to enjoy life. Man, if he's born into this world, he's burdened with a certain task, a certain mission, and he's got to fulfill his mission. Akil Sofi, not so much foreseen as ever, God under scrutiny and more or less God expects him to do. You know what faith is? Faith does not mean only. Faith does not mean only I foresee. Faith means I expect. Faith, mamileo. Faith, mamileo. So it means watchman. The watchman who expects to see something. The watchman who waits for the dawn, for the daybreak. Faith, mamileo. So you say, I insistio, I mean, I insistio, it's more longing, I mean, I long, I yearn, I expect, I mean, Akil Sofi, the Creator expects something of man. It's not just man, it's just a being who has no objective, there's no destination for him. Man, the Creator expects man to do something. Okay. This is number one, I mean, the sense of responsibility, I mean. To know that there is, I mean, this is knowledge, there is a moral law, and the moral law is not of my making, of my own making, but it's imposed upon me, and I have to surrender to the moral law. It's very simple. That's Akil Sofi. Virtus Nesuna, what is Virtus Nesuna? Freedom of man. But first of all, man, it is almost mutually exclusive. On the one hand, man is bound by a law, by duty. He has to surrender. On the other hand, he's a free being. If he wants to rebel against the and he should comply with it, not because somebody will constrain him or somebody will force him, of his own free will. This is the greatness of man. I mean, for instance, many laws, people comply with many laws, and this is true of modern society, because they are simply afraid, I mean, of consequences, of an indictment. I mean, people pay taxes because they are afraid. And if they can cheat, they'll cheat as much as possible. And so many another crimes, I mean, are not committed because people are afraid. I mean, actually the restraining factor is fear. But the others didn't want men, I mean, simply to withdraw from sin or crime or violations, I mean, because of fear. The others wanted him to do so of his own free will, I mean. He should enjoy full freedom. Akil Sofi, Virtus Nesuna. And man has full freedom. Interesting is, he calls freedom Reshus. Why is freedom Reshus? To be Chayrus Nesuna. Or you say, Ratzin Chofshi, free will, Chayrus, Chufsho, is freedom. I mean, there are many words for freedom. Why it's called reshus? Reshus is not freedom. Not only freedom, reshus is more than freedom. What is reshus? Huh? No, nothing real, nothing real. No. We use it, I mean, we use reshus in the sense of permission, but it is more than that. Reshus is authority. Reshus means power. Power. Power, Rishayach, it means also under control, which is the possession. But there is another expression here. Just a moment here. Hevizirim bereshus, Perek Sheni, 184. Be careful. What is careful about? With the authority, with power, these people who possess power, with the authority. He meant the Roman authorities, probably. The vizier in Bershus, don't be too friendly with people in authority, with people of power, I mean. His Rishus Nasuna means not only man is free to carry out his assignment, but he has the power to carry out his assignment. And this is an old Jewish idea. I mean, if there is a moral law, the question is man capable of implementing the moral law? Is not capable. It's not enough. Freedom is given to me. All right, I can have freedom, I mean, but if I want to give now $10,000 to Yeshiva, I don't have the money. No use, I mean, I'm free. Of course I'm free. I can put my hands in my pocket. But I'll find an empty pocket. If I make out a check for $10,000, would not be honored by any day. The question is man capable of implementing the moral law? Not only is he free. Free is certainly free. And when you said Chiro Chofshis, if man is free, the Rambam has always emphasized, freedom means not only freedom of decision. Freedom, according to Kant, for instance, the German philosopher, man is free to decide in favor of the moral norm. But as far as implementation is concerned, he's already limited, I mean. And he's restrained by environmental factors. I mean, jihadists thought differently, that man is not only free to make the right decision, but man is free and he has power and authority, I mean, to carry out his decision, to implement the right decision. This is what Rishus is about. I mean, it's not sure. Our concept of freedom, I mean, transcends, I mean, that of the philosophical, of moral freedom. Moral freedom philosophy means only the moral freedom to decide. The rest is up already, I mean, to reality, I mean, to providence. But the Yahadus is actually man is free and he has enough power to implement the moral or not. And that's what Chazal always says. Le'nitna teiro le'malachi ashoi. The Torah has not been given to you. You don't have to be a superhuman being in order to implement the moral law. A normal human being can implement the normal law and live a immoral life. This is Rishus Nesuna. And that's what he, that's then. V'hakol l'fireiv ha'maaseh. Everything depends not upon your decision, but upon your deed, upon your work. Yehadus always, Yehadus has never, for instance, Yehadus is very seldom, not really seldom, but Yehadus was not interested so much in the motivation as in the deed itself. And the Gemara says, Mark Nisse, Bitpumid Rav, Rav used to say, Leilom Yasek Odom, Beterob Mitzvah Shalei Lishmo, even if a man is motivated by selfish reasons to study Torah and to do mitzvahs and to be charitable because of publicity, because he wants to enjoy the respect of his contemporaries, let him do it. What counts is the word, the deed. The motivation is of secondary importance. And if you are engaged in good deeds, in good works, finally the motivation will actually, I mean, be enhanced. This is Yadus. V'hakei l'firei v'ma'aseh. Everything is not in accordance with motivation, but in accordance with your work. What's the use if I'm motivated in a positive fashion, if I lack the courage, if I lack the courage, or I don't have the fortitude, I mean, to implement my decision. Many people are motivated, I mean, absolutely, but by ideal bei Riesen kamen, bei Maulriesen. Natürlich sind sie ein Rauer, denke ich. Sie hacken literäre Maße. So it means, when you say man is free, it's not enough to say free in order to reach a good decision. But means to do, I mean, to implement my decision. Ube tuv o'elom nidem, the final destiny of the world, will be decided with goodness and mercy. It means, no matter how corrupt the world is at present, no matter how corrupt the world is at present, and how wicked it is, and Rabbi Akiva certainly had a right to say so. So men should never despair, should never give up hope. So this is a basic in the habit. So the world, in the near or distant future, it's very hard to say. But there is a Bayimahu on that day, and the world will be completely purged and cleansed and redeemed of wickedness, tyranny, injustice, and iniquity and so forth. The two goal of me, the final judgment of the world, is a puzzle of the world. That's what Rabbi Akiva said. Rabbi Akiva the martyr, whom the world has persecuted and killed and tortured. Rabbi Akiva the representative of Bar Kokhba, who fought against the wickedness. He actually fought with ammunition, fought against. Rabbi Akiva the one who saw, witnessed both the destruction of Jerusalem. He was a young boy. And the family was called, he was an old man during the Bar Kokhba revolution. The ruthlessness and the cruelty of the civilized world. Who was the civilized world that I mean, it's not Rome? Classical Rome, I mean, which represented Hellas and culture, Greek culture, and the Latin culture as well. But still Rabbi Akiva did not condemn the world. He said, Chaviv Adam Shinivra Betzalam Elokim, he's a great being, he's a great being. He himself doesn't know. And Chibo Yisera Nejas, like Shinivra, and important he is. You see, a greater law is made known to him, if he himself will understand it. He will understand that he is a spiritual being. And what does his greatness consist of? What are the, his, first of all, sense of responsibility, hakil sofui, freedom and power to carry out the assignment, every man has an assignment, to implement the assignment, implement not only as far as decisions are concerned, or intentions are concerned, but as far as the work and deeds are concerned, lakal esarei lamase, and particularly men must have faith in the world, because finally the world will be redeemed, will be paid for evil means. The world will finally be treated and judged in a positive way. That's the Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzalem Elokim. That's Rabbi Akiva. And that's why Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva is interesting. Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, we apparently did not understand one aspect of Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzalem Elokim. If man is dignified, no matter how wrong he is, no matter how wrong he is, you should not embarrass him, you should not humiliate him, you should not hurt his feelings, you should treat him with respect and deference. Yeah. Huh? The world. Or Elam doesn't mean the world is man. Man is the world. When you speak about the world, you don't, when you say, I was a son in Hebrew Elam, I was a son in the world, was created. Not the inorganic or organic world, but many of us like that. No. Bituv o'elam nidim. The world will be judged with mercy and kindness. It means finally God will have mercy upon the world and he'll redeem the world and he'll raise the world to a high level of perfection. That's what it means. Bituv o'elam nidim. Yehakeru tirei v'mahat. But the world can be redeemed only through words, not through decisions, and not through sermons, and not through philosophy. Matter of fact, there is no other people on earth which has written so many works on ethics and morality, and beautiful works, books rather, as the Germans. Take a look at their performances. between Kant's ethics and the performance. You have the Prussian and the performance of the Prussian army. Why should we take out the Germans? Take Christianity. Read the gospel is love and love and love. And take the history of Christianity, false and false and false, and brutality and brutality and brutality. The Hadith did not speak so much about love, but still, our history is still much cleaner than that of other people. But this is what Rabbi Akiva understood by human dignity. Awareness of responsibility and assignment, awareness of freedom and power to carry it out, to implement it, to engage in ethical deeds, and to believe in the final destiny of man. That's what it is. It's rather clear. Of course, if Talmidov lay on a Gukovic the other day, he did not understand the dignity of man. And dignity of man, I'll tell you, is very important, for instance. It's important now for particularly in our modern times. You see, I always say there are two kinds of tichocha. You know what tichocha means in Europe. I would rather say to preaching. You see, there is what I call it in Hebrew, tichocha shlili, the negative way of preaching. You approach a person who apparently actually violated some moral norms, and you rebuke him. You rebuke him. You censure his being. You condemn him. You condemn him. And you tell him that he's bad. And you try simply to downgrade him, to denigrate him, hoping that by insulting him or embarrassing him, privately or publicly, by downgrading him, by telling him that he's no good, that he's wrong, by censuring him and rebuking him, he'll bring him back. Perhaps this method was quite working years, centuries ago. Because the person, whenever the person was rebuked by the rabbi, by the teacher, by the preacher, he was actually expelled by the community. Many times, quite often excommunicated, and the person couldn't live in loneliness. He used to come back and repent and say confession and join the killer. I always doubt whether this kind of repentance is sincere and it flows from the inner recesses of the human personality. It's simply fear. What you do is you put a man in jail in order to get out of jail. He'll plead guilty, or on the contrary, in order to get a milder sentence, a lighter punishment, he'll plead guilty. But it's not repentance. He has no contrite heart. It is simply in order to, it's just a way how to simply to save himself, to protect himself, and to join the community. There is another way how to preach the person. To tell a person, on the contrary, but even though you have committed, for instance, many Jews nowadays are so far away, so remote from Yahadut, that it's impossible to bring them back by rebuking them and telling them that they are wrong. First of all, they don't understand why they are wrong. They don't understand it at all. And they have no concept of Yahadut. We live now in a very strange era. No country. This is the majority of the Jews now. There's no country. They know what it is. There is another way how to approach people, and I believe this way is the more effective, and it produces magnificent results. Someone told me that when I was in 1935 in Eretz Yisrael, I want to give you an example. 1935 in Eretz Yisrael, I visited still in existence a kibbutz. It's called Kinneret. Kinneret is on the Galilean Sea. It was a kibbutz of the Shomer HaTzair. I don't know now what kind of. What kind of political philosophy they gave the people and that Kibbutz profess, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But at that time it was very radical Kibbutz, complete. I wanted people to transvaluate all values. Complete secular agnostic, I would say atheist Kibbutz. And I came there. The work was about enormous. It was very hard because it was right there in the job. It was very hard. It's across the Kinneret from Siberia. It was very hard, and they were in the field. They came from the field, half naked. And they treated me to serve fruit, grapes, oranges, I don't know. And apparently noticed that I did not take them. So they told me apparently I'm afraid of several of whom it's my turn. And I said, oh, you disagree, no. I said, yes. And everything in our place is mistaken. Whom it's my turn to set apart. And it's something the other story. Our kitchen is strictly kosher. Strictly kosher? So they told me a very funny story. But a couple of years before, and I said that, before I came, a Rav Kook visited the Kibbutz. And he came Friday, late afternoon, accompanied by his gabbai, by his zawas, and he asked them for permission to spend Sabbath with them. So they all heard him come with him. So it was Friday Eve, and we wanted to get a minion for Kabbalah Shabbos, and they refused to come. They refused to come. They said they don't believe in God. They refused to come. They refused to come Saturday morning either, so he doubled privately without priest affairs, what I can affair is along, but he couldn't use it in affairs. They refused to join him. And he ate, he brought some food, some bread, and some milk he brought. They couldn't join them in the meal because of the place. And he didn't say what. He didn't say what. He yelled, he shouted, he communicated with anybody. No shouting would have been acceptable. And then Saturday night, they made a bonfire and they danced around the horror. So he joined them. And he spent with them almost the whole night until the early hours in the morning. And he began to talk to them. And he said, "Good sir." And he told them, "I want to ask you," and he started his address to them with the following question. "Could you tell me who you are?" "We are Jews." "Are you observing Jews?" "Oh no, we don't observe." "Do you believe in God?" "We don't believe." "Are you committed Jews?" "To Jewish values?" "No, we are socialists and so forth. We don't believe in a secular order and so forth." "But I'll ask you one question. What if some Arabs will come with explosives and he'll try to destroy the people of our world? What will you do?" "What will we do? We'll fight for it. We'll protect the people of our world. If necessary, will you sacrifice your life?" "Certainly." "So you are good Jews. So why do you say you don't believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu? If you didn't believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you would not protect the Teiko Marovi. What significance, what relevance was the Teiko Marovi to you if you don't believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu?" And he spoke just for half hour. He knew how to speak about it. Half hour. And then he didn't say when they were sitting and just listening to him. And then he put together, he took the Shabbos and Shil, motioned to the Shabbos. And they got into the car, and they drove off. And then there, they were driving already, he turned around and said, "Children, next year I'll come again, but I hope you'll join me for a meal, and I'll be able to join you again at your meal." And the next day, the Patasha was it. They changed the train. And it's a story which is not a legend, they told me. This is the way how to work now, you can't work otherwise. All those methods of communicating, isolating, are completely ineffectual. Ineffectual. This is you must have faith in man and in the Jew in particular. And actually, I mean, now, don't boys, young boys, come from secular background, completely secular, sacrifice their lives, I mean, every day you eat. That boy was killed, other boy was killed. Now you're always interested to where they come from. They come from Shemir HaTzair Kibbutzim. So there is commitment in them. If there is commitment, so and anything is possible. Anything is possible. If there is the spark, that fire, I mean, you can actually, you can develop, I mean, flame out of that little fire. You can build, actually, a tremendous fire. That's what Rav Akiva said, Fakil Tzafui Varshut Nesuno, the two Va'ilam Nidim. Men should know that there is some good in the world, no matter how corrupt it is. No matter how ignorant the world itself is of its own endowment, of its own inner endowment. No matter how ignorant the Jew is of his own commitment. He should arouse in him the knowledge, he should inform him, he should tell him. Don't tell him so much about things, but tell him the great potential we have. Chibo Yisero Nedas Lei Shenivram Tzarkim, that God told him so. That's Rabbatim. That's why he's permitting when they treated their own associates. Perhaps, I mean, they were right. Apparently they found fault with that. But they acted disrespectfully vis-à-vis their friends, so that's why they died. That's the Chazal. It's Rav Akiva talking. Who became oil of meaning. When you judge the world, look from the positive. If you'll say the world is bad and completely corrupt, and there is no hope for man, there's no hope, and man is a brute, I mean, he's just, I mean, only force, I mean, counts, and he doesn't understand what moral law stands for. And if you have the same approach to Jews, I mean, because we are now in the minority. The Jew is the minority vis-à-vis mankind. Traditional Jews, Orthodox Jews, are in the minority now vis-à-vis the great mass of Jews. If we should say just abandon them, forget about them, or you wouldn't achieve anything. It's not a question of liberalism or Orthodoxy. If you want to bring them back, a part of them or some of them, you should accept the attitude of the table ilam nidhi. The world has got to be treated with mercy and understanding. And one has got to find some good in the world, otherwise you cannot live. If you find some good in a person, so then you can approach it. Then your approach is a dignified approach. You don't insult him, you don't embarrass him, you don't yell at him, you don't shout at him. Then it's a different approach. You want to rebuke him, but in a different manner. You show him, on the contrary, the potential greatness of him. And he will rebuke himself. There will be no need for you to censure him. That's what I think. Who betrayed the two Va'ilam Nidim. That's why Chazal say that Mrs. Lemna was positive about that. He did not understand human dignity. And the one who did not understand human dignity could not act as Rabbi Akiva's Talmud. Very strange. 24,000 Talmudim, what do you know about it? Not a single. For reason, not a single aloche, not a single minor has been perpetuated. What do you know? All we know about Rabbi Akiva is through the five Talmidim whom he taught as an old man after he lost 24,000 Talmidim. You know, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Nissi, you know. There the tradition was perpetuated. 24,000 Talmidim is. I mean, we should have inherited a spiritual treasure from them. But somehow they were wiped off and forgotten. And if Rabbi Akiva had been immortalized in our annals, is because of the size, all the five families he found in the southern part of Eretz Israel. And he began to train them from the scratch. As an old man, according to Chazal, he was very old out of here when he came to God. And he simply, and the miracle of resurrection of the church, and the Torah was restored. This is number one. Number two, there is something else in the Braise which is very important. What is it? The new COVID debate is important, as I explained to you, this radical principle of dignity. And he was the first one. So the first one was the Chumash. What emphasizes Yahadut considers dignity of man as a central principle was radical. COVID was the machine of the Torah. Noah the philosopher has expressed it in such a beautiful form. In the first sentence, Ezra the Akiva did. No other philosophy. As a matter of fact, dignity of man is a late already on the European philosophy. Why? It's a thought which came very late. Because Christianity, on the contrary, saw men as a corrupt being who cannot be redeemed. And if he can be redeemed, it's only by grace of God. He himself cannot do anything. And that's what Rabbi Akiva says, no, God will not redeem you. You have to redeem yourself. No, shoot me sooner. It's your job. It's your responsibility. If you will redeem yourself, you will raise yourself, so God will accept you. He will help you, yes. A volunteer, the sign. But you have to take the first, you have to make the first leap. You have to take the initiative. Yeah, what else is important in that brighter? I told you, historically, you don't know much about it, whatever. But in any story which Chazal has told us, there are more lessons involved. What else? What else? Very important for us to... Very, very effective. Sorry, you're right. It's never too late to teach, I mean, to learn first to teach. To teach people. It's never too late to start all over again. Very hard to start all over again. Very hard. It's hard in business. When you are a young man, and you start out full of energy and vigor and hope. You can do anything. You can build up a fortune. But if one should lose his fortune, and he's not a kid at all, and he's 40, 50, and to start from the scratch all over again is very difficult. To construct is hard. To reconstruct is still harder. To build is hard. It's difficult to build. But to rebuild, to build and to lose, and to rebuild is much harder. Koshe atikin lechadite chazal. It's hard. Repetition is very hard. Particularly when you gave your life to certain ideals, and you've achieved, and you are very successful, and suddenly within a short period of time, within one short night, you lost everything you had. And you find yourself at the very beginning, at the same spot where you were so many years ago. At that time, you were young, you were vigorous, you were ambitious, you had hope, and you could. And you had a tremendous drive and you could move. But now everything is gone. So how can you start from this time? He had 24,000 Talmidim. His name was known, Chazal Yevamos Mitzvah Matzeis. The entire Jewish world knew him. He was the greatest scholar and leader, and Rabbi Akiva Chalero, central figure. And suddenly all his admirers disappeared. I had to find five young boys and start to train them and teach them holidays and chumash and train them as scholars. Very hard. It's unfortunately that this is our destiny. It's not only Rabbi Akiva's destiny. It's the Jewish destiny. If you ask me what is so characteristic of Jewish history, what is characteristic of Jewish history? Many things are unique. But the most unique feature is the repetition. we are engaged in continuous repetition. To do things which we have done 500 times, and we have succeeded and lost, and we have to start from the scratch all over again. All over again. That was, we were in Bereshit. We entered Eretz Israel during the time of Joshua. We conquered the land. We finally developed the commonwealth. It was a very slow process, very slow process. We built a Beit HaMikdash. And we lived on our land so many hundreds of years. And suddenly, within a short period of time, everything was erased, destroyed and devastated. We lost the land, but dislocated, displaced completely. We lost our language because in the times of Ezra we lost our language. The Hebrew was completely lost in the times of Ezra. Basically, Hebrew was lost in the times of Ezra. Not like, I mean, they spoke a jargon, I mean. And then Ezra started some distress all over again. I think to Jerusalem, he had a harder job than Yeshua. I mean, you know the story how the book Nehemiah and Ezra portrayed the restoration of Jerusalem, the sacrifices, the opposition on the part of the Sanballatim, the internal, I mean, the insecurity and the poverty of the people. Right? Then, right, how long did we stay in Eretz Israel the second time? According to Chazal, 420 years. According to historians, a little longer. Right? I mean, 590, 80 years, and so forth. Again, exile. Again, the same. And we have started all over again, I mean, in every country we came to. Take, for instance, an institution like Harvard. America is a young country. It's over 300 years old. Do you have a Jewish institution which is over 300 years old? You don't have. Why don't you have an institution of learning which is 300 years old? For a simple reason. You know why? So the world is story. If we could, there is no continuity on this. There is no continuity on this. We had Suram competition. Suram competition existed for several years. Then we were erased completely. With the rise of the Islam, the Babylonian Jews were completely displaced and dislocated and so forth on. For instance, we have the annals, I mean, we have documents that the Jews in the 13th and 12th century in France had a beautiful educational system, building magnificent structures on it, where they taught their children. Within 150 years, I mean, the Jews were exiled from France. The buildings were taken over by the monastic order, converted into churches or Catholic schools. We have lost. We came here, we established schools again, we lost. Holland, we have so many institutions, lost. Okay. Now we are building in America, somebody scratch, somebody is here, come here. And it's very funny, the Jew doesn't get tired. But there is some drive to him. He has faith. This is typical, Rabbi Akiva's destiny is typical of our destiny. Repetition. Repetition. What are we doing in our point of not to repeat what we have done twice already? What we did twice. During the first Commonwealth, during the second Commonwealth, now it is the third Commonwealth. And twice. And this, that's very typical of the destiny of the Jew. Achibor Rav Akiva is the Dorem. He didn't lose faith. He didn't lose hope. I mean, he had 24,000 pupils. They were a disaster struck. He lost them. Let us start all over again. From this time. This is the way you have to do things. And as a matter of fact, in today's portion of the week, we read about it. That if one loses his capital and his estate that he inherited from his ancestors, he had to sell out. So his relatives should come next of kin and help him redeem. We are in a continuous process of redemption. Redeem something which we have lost, which is pawned, which was surrendered to others. It's a complete, it's a process of redemption. That's Rabbi Akiva. That's Rabbi Akiva. As a matter of fact, Rabbi Akiva's history, I mean his biography, matter of fact, you'll find his biography, it's not just fragments of his biography, you'll find it once in Ksubes, and once in Adarim, and also once in Pirkei de Rabbanot, in Perek Vov, Pirkei de Rabbanot. And I will just to read a few lines in order to show you, the rest will continue next time. My hoyo have a misadig bafaragleyan, sit in the dust at the feet of the scholars. They say that summer is the rain and drink thirstily the water that they were. So the matter is the spiritual brother says, third sushi, the radakil, is the first radakil. My hoyo trilos of radakil, what were the beginnings of radakil? Omru, tradition, we know from tradition, Ben Arboim Shonahoyo, he was 40 years old, so the Shonahoyo, he didn't learn anything, he was a complete illiterate. Pamachas, he was a shepherd. You know who are shepherds? And shepherds, what I mean, the lawyers, people, I mean, stupid people could not understand, who were outcasts, actually. I mean, not fully wanted to accept those people. So the only, they couldn't learn any trade or any craft because they were dull. So the only trade which they could engage in was to tend to squat. Oyeimed, Alafia Beer, he was standing near the mouth of well. Omar, Nihokak Evenzu. What has hollowed out, I mean, that stone? There was a cavity in the stone. Oma, Omru, so they answered him. He asked, he didn't understand, he was not intelligent, he was dull, he didn't know. Omru, lay my, the water. She told you, Nathan Malaya Baholyin, the water drips on the stone every day, every minute. What does a drop of water mean? Vis-a-vis a stone, a hard stone, but still, if you consider the water continues to drip, day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute, finally it hollows out a cavity in the stone. Omole Akive, Apostle, it's a verse. Yatukere, you never read. Avonim Sochakumayim. The water has hollowed out, I mean, the stone. He never heard of the process. Niyadoya Rabbi Akiva don kalvachilabasa. Immediately Rabbi Akiva began to compare himself to the stone and to the water. Marach peiseles akoshe. Water is stopped. Liquid. Can still, I mean, pierce with something hard, like a stone. Divrei Torah, the words of Torah. She koshek habazel, that's very hard, very forceful, like a piece of iron. There is impact to Divrei Torah. Allah has kamo v'kamo, is in circles. She yechakeku eslibi, it's getting grave in my heart. She bustle adam, it consists just of pieces. Miyad holach v'umeter. Immediately he went off. He dropped his face, being a shepherd, and went off to study God. Golachu Bnei, he and his little child, he had a child. The Yoshua from Melamed Tinekes, and he sat down before an elementary teacher, Melamed Tinekes, and he was a teacher with good children. An old father, about 40, and a little child, the same grade. Amalei Rebbe, Lamdei Tera, I went to study God. Ochas Rabbi Akiva Bereisha Luach, Rabbi Akiva held down to that side, Ubnei The Reish HaShoni fell down to the other side. Kosav Le'alef, so the teacher wrote an Aleph and A. The Lindo, Tof the Lindo, the Kacho Yeshiv Elemet. And he started. Until he reached the Academy of Rabbeleva Rabbi Yisrael. It took him some time, you know, to tell that. So what does this story, this is the little you know about his Rabakiv's background. What are the basic ideas in that story? What are the basic ideas? What are the basic ideas? Yes, the secret, of course. First, determination, complete determination on the part of Rabbi Akiva, of course. Yeah, but this determination on the part of Rabbi Akiva, I mean, is based upon two principles, actually, are nurtured by two ideas. One idea, there are two ideas in this, actually. It's not too late to learn, correct. I mean, it's not too late to learn. And first of all, I mean, the ability to take abuse. Because to study as an adult, things which little children study, you understand very well that children have a quicker, I mean, their sense of comprehension is quicker. I mean, and are brighter than an adult. An adult has no receptive mind anymore. A child has a receptive mind, and a child remembers well, you know, very well. Certain things an adult cannot learn at all, particularly elementary things. An adult cannot learn elementary things. Yeah. So to go off with his son, with a little son, and to sit down in front of him, a lamek in acres, and both held on to the same tablet, I mean, it is the ability of simply of taking abuse, humiliating, and denigrating oneself in order to gain knowledge. And Rabbi Akiva said it later. Rabbi Akiva expressed it later. Siyog l'chokhmah shtiko, also the perek quotes Rabbi Akiva. Firstly, Siyog l'chokhmah shtiko. The hedge around wisdom is silence. Doesn't mean that. Yeah, I mean, people interpret that he isn't a fool. Keeps quiet, so people will not find out that he's a fool. It's not, that's not what Rabbi Akiva meant. Rabbi Nagina doesn't interpret like that. Siog la'chokhma shtiko, if you want to study, if you want to learn, so please be quiet, be silent, be mute, accept everything. Accept insults, accept abuse, accept discipline, accept rebuke. In order to study, one must be capable of disciplining himself. Yog la'chokhma means, shtiko means don't react. Some people poke fun at you, some people will rebuke you. One will say, see, an old man is studying ABC, and so forth on, and take everything for granted. Don't respond, and don't react. It is Yog L'chokhmah Shtiko. And I'll tell you, I know from my own experience, in order to succeed, in one study, in order to accomplish a great deal, one must be ready to take abuse, to tolerate all idiosyncrasies and all shiginis of a teacher. If he knows that a teacher is a good one, sometimes he does. I'm sure a teacher is a good one. He's not a good pedagogue either, I mean, then you don't have to suffer. But if he is a good teacher, so simple surrender to him if you want to accomplish his idea. I know myself. I had in Gemara, I had one teacher, my father. My father was an excellent teacher, a teacher of divine grace. But at the same time, he was a very hard teacher, very exacting, very demanding. And when he used to study with me, and he explained to me, but next day I had to repeat. So I had to repeat almost the same words he used. And heaven helped me. if I left out a word or I added my own word. But I could take it. I took it. Some people couldn't take it. I took it. And whatever I know belongs to him. He's responsible for that. But I was a young child. I was a young boy. But for an adult, it means it is sacrificial role. Basically, to study means to sacrifice. If the Talmud is not ready to sacrifice, he will never be a great scholar. And Rabbi Akiva is the personification of sacrifice. Of course, later in life, you know. But one of the greatest sacrifices, it's a very hard sacrifice. The sacrifice consists of humiliation and rebuke and embarrassment every day, every hour. Every hour. Every hour. This is Rabbi Akiva. Why? Because Rabbi Akiva had faith in what? He had faith in himself. He had faith in himself. Because he had faith in man. In himself. And that man is responsive. Particularly Jew is responsive to Torah. Just has got to be exposed. It will take a little longer, it will take more time. And that is basically his philosophy, the Teva Elam Midin, the Hakir is the Reva Mar. That's what Rabbi Akiva was. And that's why I say, for instance, years ago when I came to America, I visited various shuls, and so at that time, the sermon actually was the central part of the sermon, the central part. A good rabbi meant a good preacher, a good orator, who could entertain the people. This has changed completely. This has changed completely for a simple reason. Because America today has found more culture. More culture. More refined. I mean, they cannot just to listen to a sermon, no matter how beautifully constructed. It's a little hard on a cultured person, on a personally intelligent person. Because usually a sermon has no content. A sermon has no content. Now the job of a rabbi is that of a teacher. Not so much of a preacher, but of a teacher. People want to study Yahadit. You see, they don't want to be entertained emotionally, and that the rabbi should tell them how beautiful Yahadis is. They want to understand. They are intellectually minded. They want to explore Yahadis, simply explore. Now the intellectual climate of the country is actually stimulated, actually. And there is curiosity, there is inquisitiveness. And that's what rabbi, and basically this is the finest method to expose people to Yahadis. Expose people to Yahadus, so you can do it in a double way, in a twofold way. First of all, expose them to knowledge. To knowledge. Simply study text with them, I mean, try to analyze ideas, to isolate ideas, I mean, and particularly show to them how relevant ideas which have been formulated 1900 years ago, how relevant they are, I mean, to our lives. Many events, contemporary events, can be placed in frame of reference, historical frame of reference from antiquity. It's very important. And if a Jew is exposed to knowledge, and you keep on hammering at it, it's avonim socha kumai, it's like little drops of water, day in, day out, week in, week out, and they'll finally pierce through the stone, no matter how hard and tough his heart is. No matter how vulgar it is to you, he will respond. In general, man responds to knowledge, and the Jew responds to Torah, to Yahadus. This is Rabbi Akiva's philosophy. There is a response. It's sometimes slow, very slow, I'll tell you frankly. The response of American Jews to Yahadus is a very slow one. But there is the beginning, you see already the beginning of the response. Very slow. This is number one, you have to expose the Jew. There's another way in which to expose the Jew. not only to knowledge. Of course, to knowledge, one has got to be a teacher, one has got to be a pedagogue, and has got to know what to teach. Some people, I mean, cannot teach. I mean, no matter how enormous their erudition is, they cannot teach. And if they do try to teach, that is for it. They teach the wrong thing. I know such people. I don't know why. I think scholars are the highest caliber, but they cannot impart knowledge. Cannot impart knowledge. In my opinion, it is, I mean, because if you say the word is a bad pedagogue, all right. They lack midas ha-chesed, basically, to teach. And I told you many times, it's an act of charity, of giving of oneself. If a person cannot give of himself, he has no chance to be a good teacher. Because mechanical teaching does not accomplish much. It might accomplish in fields, in technical fields like mathematics, physics, also you need a good teacher. The charisma is necessary in everything. But particularly Yahadus, where it is not only an intellectual knowledge, but it's more also an experience. If you want to impart an experience, so you have to somehow to share with the person. There should be existential sharing and participating. It's very hard. But a good teacher can accomplish a great deal nowadays, much more than he could have 30 years ago. That time American Jew was not ready to study. The middle aged, the old Jew, I mean, it was a cynic in general, who didn't believe in the future of Judaism in this country, didn't believe. I mean, that's why they sacrificed their own children. Because to them it was a matter of the past. It's just exceptions, individuals. I found they had some tenacity, display tenacity. Secondly, even the youth, I was not ready to study, was not ready to respond, was not in a receptive mood. So the youth had a different objective now, to make good, I mean, to make good music. Somehow it was a certain philosophy of opportunism actually prevailed in the United States. I mean, this was actually what motivated the youth to study, certain opportunism, prospects of a glorious career, and a glorious career meant simply in terms of 2 cars in the ground and 2 cheese, 5 tickets in the car. You know the Hoover's wallet. So this is number one. Now the situation has changed. Now it's at one in Socha Kumari. There are not stones, I mean, basically. People are ready to study to understand. And the Mayim, they begin to do it systematically and are crystal clear. This is just an accomplished great deal. Can feel actually through the personality. Number one, what the youth today should be exposed, but this is already harder, is the way of life. It's the one of them in Sahakamai. You impart Yahadus not only to teaching, but to practicing as well. And they should be exposed to Jewish life in its best. If you can find it, I don't know, but it's very important. Because daily first scholars of all has influenced people not only by their brothers. My grandfather has trained a generation of scholars. Yes, I mean, after all, he revolutionized the methodology of halacha. He revolutionized completely. Without, it's not for him to be impossible to teach halacha to people who have a modern training. Yes. But how did he influence, I mean, not scholars who didn't train? But the average person on the street, after all, he was admired by thousands, by tens of thousands of people, by his way of life, I mean, by his works of charity, by his commitment. I mean, this is very important. I mean, very important. If you any statistics about, for instance, religious dissidents or people who were believers and then embrace an agnostic philosophy. If you ask them, what is the reason for their, let's say, betrayal or departure? So 90% of 100 will not tell you because of philosophy, or because I realize that it's impossible to believe in supernatural phenomena. No. The answer is the standard answer, which you get if you inquire in any inquiry, in any college, because they met with people who supposedly are religious. and you don't practice anything in your life. Because the method is hypocrisy of the priest. This is the most dangerous situation. It's simply we religious Jews make mockery of the principles we preach. And a Jew should practice not only cooking but mishpatim as well. We are inclined to practice cooking, but sometimes the mishpatim we overlook. Honesty and sincerity and sympathy and sensitivity and understanding, it's very important. It's also a one in Shachar Kumar. Rabbi Akiva practiced both. I became one hand, he was a great scholar who knew how to teach people. On the other hand, he was a great ethical personality. He did not rely on others. When the rebellion broke out, he joined the ranks. He was the one who assembled the Jews at the street corners and saw them contrary to the edict released by Rome. And that's how his name became perpetuated. The ideal of the Jewish scholarship. All right?